told him the news, seemed genuinely excited for me. After speaking to him, I spent much of the evening on the phone, talking to various relatives. Micah was almost the last person I talked to that day, and he was silent for a long moment after I finally told him the news. "You're kidding," he finally said. "It's unreal, isn't it? $1 million? For a book that you wrote? Can you believe it?" "Not right this moment, but give me a second." He breathed into the phone. "This is unbelievable," he murmured before pausing again. As close as we weren't completely immune to sibling rivalry. Ever since we'd graduated, Micah had always been more successful in his various careers than I'd been. It had always made sense to both of us. He was the older brother, and aside from school and track, had been more successful in everything. He was happy for me, but I also knew that part of him wished he'd been the one with the news. Yet Micah was able to put all that aside, and his next words meant more to me than anything anyone else had said to me. "I'm proud of you, little brother. You done good." "Thanks, Micah. Now there's just one thing left." "What's that?" "You have to help me figure out how to make my million. You made yours, so now I guess I have to do it too." Though the money seemed dizzying, I decided to keep my job as a pharmaceutical rep. I didn't know how well the book would do once it was released, nor did I know whether I would be able to write a second one. Kat and I viewed our windfall in much the same way we would have viewed a winning lottery ticket. Other than the purchase of a used Ford Explorer, the clearing of our credit card debt, and a new wedding ring for Kat, we spent none of the windfall. Our years in poverty had left us both extremely cautious. The money we'd decided would go to three areas: our mortgage, funds for the kids' college educations, and retirement. Still, the months of November and December were thrilling. So much was new: book clubs and foreign rights sales, a film sale to New Line Cinema, even the editing process. And every day there was something new, something exciting to share with Kat. Yet aside from those conversations, our lives went on as normal. Thanksgiving came and went. Christmas came and went. Dana's CAT scan was clear again, making it 3 years. And she called me on our birthday to sing to me. Dad, we learned, was still seeing his girlfriend and seemed to get along well with her. In January 1996, Miles was 4 and a half and Ryan 2 years younger when we brought Miles to the doctor to prep him for the tonsil surgery he was supposed to undergo the next day. While the doctor talked to Miles, Ryan stood quietly between my wife and me. The consultation didn't take long. When the doctor turned to engage Ryan in conversation, Ryan said nothing. This didn't surprise either Kat or me. Ryan still hadn't learned to talk, we explained. And the doctor simply nodded. Right before we were to leave, however, the doctor asked us if he could visit with Ryan alone for a few minutes. "Sure," we said, thinking nothing of it. We figured the doctor would give him a lollipop or show him some of the gadgets in the office. Strangely, however, the doctor's door remained shut for almost 10 minutes. When he finally brought Ryan out of the office, we couldn't help but notice the concerned expression on his face. "What's up?" I asked. I knew the doctor well. I'd been calling on his office for months as a pharmaceutical rep and considered him a good friend. "I just spent some time with Ryan, going over a few things." He paused, drawing a long breath. He glanced down at Ryan, then back at us again. "I think," he said slowly, "Ryan may be autistic. I think Ryan may be autistic." All Kat and I could do was stare at him. My stomach knotted up, and all of a sudden I could barely breathe. The blood drained from Kat's cheeks, and the room closed in around us. Ryan stood by our side, his expression glazed and unfocused. We knew he couldn't talk. We'd even grown concerned enough to talk to his pediatrician. But we'd convinced ourselves that it wasn't anything serious. "He'll grow out of it," we'd been told. "He'll be fine." But this? They were, I still think, among the most frightening words a parent can hear. We both knew about autism. Who hadn't seen Rain Man? Or read about autism in news magazines? Or seen shows about it on television? I stared at Ryan. Was that our son? Our child? Our baby? No, I immediately thought. The doctor was wrong. Ryan wasn't autistic. He couldn't be. He was fine. I'm not going to believe it. I can't believe it. but... Deep down, I knew there was something wrong with him. Both Kat and I had known he wasn't right for months, but we had never imagined it could be this serious. It couldn't be this. Oh, please, God, not this. What do you mean, I stammered. It's a disorder. I know what it is, but why? How? The doctor patiently explained what he'd seen in the office. The lack of eye contact, lack of comprehension, inability to talk, intense focus on colorful items, lack of motor skills. We were in a daze as he went on. We already knew those things. We knew our son. We hadn't known what they meant. Is he going to be okay? I don't know. What should we do? He needs to be tested. There's a developmental center in town, and they can answer your questions better than I can. At home, Kat and I found ourselves staring at Ryan as he sat quietly in the living room, feeling a tidal wave of emotions. Denial, guilt, anger, fear, hopelessness. We spent the rest of the afternoon looking for reasons to believe what the doctor had said, and reasons to doubt him. We talked about Ryan and what we'd noticed over the years. We went back and forth for hours, talking and worrying and crying and sitting by Ryan, trying to convince ourselves that there was nothing wrong with him at all, but somehow knowing that there was. Hoping, praying, pleading. That night, when I called Micah, I could barely tell him what had happened. My hands shook when I held the receiver. My throat was tight and I couldn't get the words out without breaking down. Jesus, Micah said. Are you sure? No, I said. We don't know anything for sure. We've got to bring him in for tests. What do you need me to do? I began to cry. Micah, do you want me to come out there? Help you guys through this? You want me to find out who you should talk to? I'll do whatever you need. No, I said. That's okay. We don't know anything yet. I feel like I've got to do something. Just pray for Ryan, okay? Can you do that for him? I'll pray for all of you, he said. I'll start praying right now. The only thing I remember about the next 2 months was a sometimes nagging, sometimes overwhelming sense of worry about our son. At times, it was all I could think about. Other times, when doing something else, I'd suddenly get the strange feeling that something was wrong, and it would take a moment before I realized I'd been subconsciously thinking about my son. Dread. It permeated our home, seeped into the nooks and crannies of our lives. Over the coming weeks and months, Kat shuttled Ryan to and from various doctors in search of answers. There were long waiting lists. It took 6 weeks to have his initial evaluation completed, and I remember sitting in the office waiting for the words I didn't want to hear. Though he's 30 months of age, currently he has the developmental skills of a 14-month-old. There are other problems, too. Lack of eye contact, for example. What are you trying to say? I think there's a good chance that he has autism. Is he going to be okay? I don't know. Is there anything we can do? I don't know. What can we do at home? I don't know. There were never any answers, but always at each evaluation they recommended another test. Again, it would take another 6 weeks. Again, it was all we could think about until the day finally came. At the second evaluation in late April, after 3 long months of worry, we were seated before another doctor, who perused Ryan's file before finally glancing up at us. I'm sorry, he said, but I think we might have been in error. We don't believe Ryan is autistic, though he may have autistic tendencies. What does that mean? We think he might have pervasive developmental disorder. Is he going to be okay then? I don't know. Is there anything we can do? I don't know. For the time being, however, I'd suggest getting another test, a specialized hearing test. We want to make sure he hears sounds correctly. Another month passed. Another round of worries. Another test, another meeting with a doctor. I'm sorry, but we might have been wrong. We don't think Ryan has pervasive development disorder. What's wrong with him? Ryan, the doctor said, is profoundly deaf. We looked at the doctor. Then how come he turns when the air conditioner goes on? Oh, he does that? The doctor asked. Well, then let's give him another test. Tests. That's all they ever recommended. He got another hearing test, one that tests the inner ear. A month later, we talked to the doctor again. You were right, he said. Ryan can hear. Then what's wrong with him? The problem with your son is that he's severely retarded, with attention deficit disorder. He's not retarded, I said. He's smart. He remembers everything. Not knowing what else to do, they recommended yet another test. After that, at the next meeting, they reverted to autism again, though they categorized it as mild. At the next meeting, they switched back to a diagnosis of pervasive development disorder. No one, in other words, knew what was wrong with our son. No one could tell us what to do. No one could tell us whether he was going to be okay. No one could tell us anything. My wife lived the day-to-day struggle far more intensely than I. She took Ryan from one evaluation to the next while I worked during the day. In the evening, she handled the kids while I wrote. In the little free time I had, however, I began to read about childhood developmental disorders. I read through one book, then another, then still another. Within a couple of months, I'd read through 40 books, covering the entire spectrum of possible disorders, and a couple of hundred clinical reports outlining various therapies. It was my way of trying to cope, to handle the unknown, to somehow find a way to understand my son. I was searching for something, anything, that could lead to answers. By late August, Ryan was coming up on his third birthday. His latest evaluation showed little, if any, improvement. Now, instead of having the skills of a 14-month-old, he had the skills of a 15-month-old. In other words, after 8 months of running from doctor to doctor and after dozens of tests and evaluations, Ryan was even further behind his peers than he'd been when we'd first found out he had a problem. And he still never spoke at all. As all-encompassing as my worries were, I continued selling pharmaceuticals by day, and by early summer had begun work on a second novel. Working in the evenings and drawing inspiration from my dad and his struggles with grief, I started Message in a Bottle. The work was an escape of sorts, for only while I wrote was it possible to keep from thinking about Ryan. Micah and I stayed in frequent touch throughout those first few months of 1996. He was the one I talked to about my fears, and he would always listen. At the same time, Micah was moving forward in his own life. In April 1996, he called to tell me that he'd decided to give up his real estate career. I'm thinking of buying a business instead, he said on the phone. What kind? A manufacturing business. Garage cabinets, closet organizers, and home office systems. What do you know about that? Nothing, but the owner says he'll train me. Good for you. There's just one thing. What's that? Can I borrow some money? I'll be able to pay you back in a few months. After telling me the amount, I hesitated only briefly. Sure, I said. Thanks. Then with a quieter voice, he asked, how's Ryan doing? Micah alone among my family was the only one who never forgot to ask. There were, however, two bright spots in the first half of 1996. Again, my sister passed her CAT scan with flying colors and seemed perfectly healthy. Other than being tired, twin two-year-old boys can do that to you, she was in good spirits and we seldom talked about her health. My dad, too, finally began to find his way again. As 1996 progressed, he spoke less about Flame and began talking more about the woman he was dating. He spoke about work as well. Work was the one area of his life where he continued to function normally. And by the summer, he'd even begun listening to my request that he start talking to his family again. They miss you, I said. They're worried about you. I know, he admitted. And I'll talk to them again. I just have to be ready first. I think that my dad's hesitation had less to do with a continuing anger than fear of how they would respond to his attempted reconciliation. In the end, he put aside whatever fears he had and called his brother. Later, I would hear from my Uncle Monty that my dad did almost all of the talking, that he'd rambled a bit. But after the call, my uncle had broken down. He loved and missed my dad, and the sound of my dad's voice, even if it was less a conversation than a speech, was something he'd longed to hear. It was a step my dad had needed to make, not only for his brother, but for himself. And as the summer wore on, they began speaking more and more. After I learned what he'd done, I told my dad that I was proud of him. And for once, my dad seemed touched by my words. "I love you, Dad," I whispered. "Love you, too." And a couple of weeks later, my dad called to tell me something else. "I'm getting married," he said. "You'll like her, Nick," Micah said on the phone. I'd called to ask him about the woman my dad intended to marry. While I'd never met her, my brother had. "And she'll be good for Dad, too." "He seems happier." "I think he is," Micah said. "He even went to see Dana and the twins last weekend." "That's good," I said. I paused. "It's been a long 7 years since Mom died." "Yes, it has." "The poor guy. I was beginning to wonder if he was ever going to be okay." "Did you hear he called Uncle Monty?" "Yeah," I said. "I'm glad. He needs his family. He always has." "How's your business going?" "It's hard. I've been working day and night, but it's paying off. Sales have been going up every month." "Congratulations." He paused. "There's something else, too."
"What's that?"
"I think I finally met my Kathy," he said. "But her name's Christine."
"Really? That's great."
"Nick, you're going to love her."
"Sounds pretty serious."
"It is serious."
"Yeah, but is it marriage serious or Micah serious?"
"Ha ha." My eyebrows shot up. If he wasn't willing to joke about it, I realized I already had the answer.
"Well, good for you," I said. "I can't wait to meet her."
2 days after my father told me he was engaged, and a month prior to the publication of The Notebook, the CBS television show 48 Hours arrived at our house. One of the producers, Andrew Cohen, had read an advance copy of the book in the early part of the summer and decided to run a segment entitled The Making of a Bestseller. In addition to filming me, they'd also been filming at Warner Books all summer, sitting in on marketing meetings, conducting interviews with Larry Kirschbaum, the CEO of Warner Books, Maureen Egan, the president, and Jamie Rabb, my editor, in addition to filming a book group composed of strangers who would discuss the novel. They came to the house on a Thursday. 2 days later, on Saturday, I was supposed to fly to Los Angeles for the Southern California Booksellers Association dinner, which would be the first promotional event of my career. I was, as you might imagine, a basket case of nerves. The producer and crew had arrived early in the morning and followed me throughout the day. The crew filmed me both at home and on the job, and host Aaron Moriarty interviewed me throughout the day about the process of writing and whether or not the book would be a success. Though Aaron and Andrew left in the early evening to catch their flight back to New York, the film crew stayed at the house to get some last-minute footage of me working on my new novel. At around 9 p.m., while I was staring at the screen and typing for the camera, my wife came into the office, phone in hand.
"It's Micah," she said.
"Can you tell him I'll call him back in a half hour or so?"
"He needs to talk to you now," she said. "It's important."
"What is it?"
"I don't know, but he sounds upset."
I took the phone and felt the camera swivel toward me.
"Hey, Micah, what's up?"
"It's Dad," he said. He spoke in a low, dazed voice.
"What's going on?"
"I got a call from the police department near Reno. He's been in a car accident. I just called the hospital where they brought him in." I heard him draw a long breath. I knew enough to say nothing. I could hear the cameras from 48 Hours whirring behind me.
"He's dead, Nicky,"
Micah said quietly.
"Who?"
I asked, already knowing the answer.
"Dad," he said. "Our daddy died an hour ago."
I was paralyzed. My eyes welled with tears at the same instant that Micah started to cry.
"Dana and I are driving up to see him now," Micah went on. "I just called her and I'm going to pick her up on the way. I know he's gone, but we have to go see him."
"Oh, Micah."
"I know," he said.
"I gotta go." I hung up the phone. Throughout the conversation, Kat hadn't taken her eyes from me.
"What is it?" she asked.
I told her. My wife burst into tears and opened her arms to me. Behind us, the camera finally clicked off. Everything, I realized, had been caught on film. But the cameramen were sensitive enough to pack up and leave quietly. I stayed up most of the night, talking and crying with Kat. My brother called me sometime in the middle of the night and said that he and Dana had reached the hospital and seen my father's body.
I can't believe he's gone, Micah told me. He was clearly in shock. I just talked to him last night, and now I'll never talk to him again. How's Dana doing?
Terrible.
She hasn't stopped crying since we got here. But we'll be leaving in a couple of minutes. I mean, I don't know what else to do.
I wish I was there with you guys right now.
Me too. He paused.
When will you be coming out?
I don't know, I said.
As soon as I can. I'm supposed to be flying out to California for a bookseller's dinner this weekend, but I'll cancel.
Jesus, I still can't believe it.
It's unreal, isn't it?
And then we both started crying again. In the morning, Micah called again. As we talked about Dad, he grew quiet.
Nick, I've been thinking about your book tour, he finally said.
Me too.
You're still going to do it, right?
I doubt it, I said.
How can I?
You've got to go, he said, growing serious.
It seems wrong.
Dad was proud that you wrote the book, he said, cutting me off. He'd be the first to insist that you've got to go. He knows how important the tour is. It's your first book. It might be the only chance you get.
But I don't know if I can.
You can, Nick, and you will. I know you loved Dad, and he knows you loved him.
He loved you, too.
But you've got your own family to consider, too. Mom and Dad would want you to go. After hanging up the phone, I thought about what he had said. He was, I thought, both right and wrong. I understood his point, but at the same time it felt callous. It was like trying to choose between my dreams for the future and respect for my father. If I stayed home, would I ever get another chance? And did that matter? But if I decided to go, what then? If someone asked me if I was enjoying the tour or excited about what was happening to me, what on earth was I supposed to say? There was no easy answer to that question. I talked it over with Kat, with Dana, with Micah again, and with my relatives. I talked to my agent, publicist, and editor, all of whom said that I could cancel the tour if I felt I needed to. In the end, I reluctantly decided to go. The guilt I felt inside, however, was enormous. I couldn't shake the feeling that it was disrespectful to my dad's memory. Andrew Cohen, the producer, called soon after. In shock, he offered sincere condolences, and I asked him not to air the footage that concerned my dad's death. We both knew the show would garner higher ratings had it been aired. The current state of television bears that out. But Andrew didn't hesitate, saying he'd bury the footage. Despite my anguish over the loss of my dad, I was reminded once again of the goodness of people. I flew to California with my stomach in knots and somehow made it to the dinner. I remember nothing about the evening except for a feeling of disembodiment, as if I were watching what was happening through someone else's eyes. People asked about the new book, and I answered on autopilot, saying all the things I was supposed to say. But as I spoke, all I could think about was my dad, how wrong this felt, and how much I longed to see my siblings. After the dinner, I spent the following week in Sacramento with my brother and sister. Micah and I stayed at the house, which suddenly seemed to be nothing but a shell. At the same time, nothing seemed to have changed at all. There was a coffee cup on the kitchen counter and fresh milk in the refrigerator. Mail continued to arrive. There was a stack on the table that Micah had already brought in. The grass had just been mowed. It was easy to imagine that my dad would be driving up any minute, or even that my mom was cooking in the kitchen. The memories of both of them were vivid. And as Micah and I moved from room to room, we could think of nothing to say. I was exhausted. My mom, my sister, my dad, my son. Too many worries in too short a time. Micah had the same worn expression I did. We made arrangements for the funeral. Relatives began flying in. Everyone was in shock, and my Uncle Monty couldn't stop crying, nor could we. My dad was buried next to my mom, and the same people who gathered together 7 years earlier came to the funeral. My Uncle Jack spoke at my dad's grave and offered the sweetest eulogy I'd ever heard. The estrangement had wounded most of our relatives, but they loved him nonetheless. At the graveside, Kat and I held hands, as did Bob and Dana, and Micah and Christine. This is what I thought when I was at the funeral. My dad was a good man.
a kind man. But my mom's death had wounded him, and my sister's illness had wounded him again. He spent the last 7 years of his life struggling with sadness, in a world he no longer recognized. Yes, he'd been angry at times, even bitter, but he was my dad, and he'd helped raise us. And I not only respected him for that, but loved him for what he did. He'd fostered independence, showed us the value of education, and taught us to be curious about the world. Even more important, he'd helped the three of us become close as siblings, which I considered to be the greatest gift of all. I could have asked for nothing more in a father, and really, who could? Later, Micah, Dana, and I stood alone in front of the casket, our arms around one another, saying goodbye one last time. We missed him already. With the sun coming down hard, we were together and alone at exactly the same time, as orphan siblings always are. After the funeral, Kat and I stayed on in California for a couple of days. Miles was old enough to understand what had happened. Ryan still seemed to understand nothing at all. Over the year, Kat and I had begun to close ranks when it came to Ryan's condition. Only she and I, we believed, fully understood how challenging the year had been. And in those early years of struggle, we divided people into two groups, good and bad. Those who were kind to Ryan, and those who ignored him. We were under no illusions that he was like other children. He didn't laugh much, he didn't look at people when they spoke, nor did he understand what they said to him. Yet we wanted nothing more than for Ryan to be accepted for who he was. He was a sweet kid, a kind child, and with patience and effort, Ryan could be fun to play with. But no one besides Kat or myself ever made the effort. Unlike Miles, Ryan had no friends. Unlike Miles, none of our neighbor's kids ever wanted to play with him. Unlike Miles, Ryan was never invited to birthday parties. Unlike Miles, no one ever tried to talk to him. And adults, sadly, were no different. More often than not, they simply ignored him, or worse, took his lack of interaction personally. "He doesn't like me," neighbors said to us. Even relatives seemed to ignore him during the course of the week, adding more stress to an already stressful week. And Kat and I would have to bite our tongues to keep from screaming, "You've got to try." What we really meant was, "Please, someone try. Anyone, we love him so much and you have no idea how frightened we are for him." We kept this to ourselves while we divided the world into groups. We'd been handling Ryan's problems on our own, and we'd continue to do so. We didn't want people to pity Ryan or pity us. We wanted them to love Ryan as much as we did, even if something was wrong with him. 2 days after the funeral, Kat and I went out to pick up groceries. Micah had offered to stay with Miles and Ryan, and when we left, Micah was slogging through paperwork in my dad's office. When we got back to the house, however, Micah was no longer at the desk. Instead, Micah was wrestling gently with Ryan in the living room. And more than that, Ryan was laughing. Laughing. The sound was incredible. Had it come from heaven itself, it would have been no less joyous. And all Kat and I could do was stare. "Oh, hey, guys," Micah said, as if nothing extraordinary was happening. "We're just having some fun." Micah didn't have to be told how Kat and I were feeling. Micah already knew. My book tour lasted nearly 3 months. Kat was on her own with the kids, continuing to haul Ryan from one doctor to the next, and the incredibly stressful year had taken its toll on our marriage. It wasn't any single occurrence that caused the tension between Kat and myself. In large part, it had to do with the fact that our marriage had been careening from one crisis to the next almost since we walked down the aisle. Our marriage had been less a permanent state of bliss than an attempt to endure a twisted version of survival camp, and the emotions had to flow somewhere. For me, they flowed toward Kat, and for her, they flowed toward me. Our marriage was already under tremendous duress, and Ryan's problems became the breaking point. While I worried tremendously about him, my worries were nothing compared to my wife's. I think it has something to do with motherhood. It's an almost instinctive response. She had carried Ryan in her womb. She had nursed him as a baby. And while I worked outside the home, she had been the one caring for him every minute of every day. As the Christmas season approached, we seemed unable to enjoy each other's company as we once used to. we were also arguing more. I knew my wife not only deserved a break, but needed a break. She'd been on full-time duty for 3 months while I was on tour, and for Christmas my gift to her was a trip to Hawaii. While she spent a week with a friend, I would stay home with the kids. While it may strike some people as odd, if we were having trouble, why didn't I offer to go with her? The answer is simple. Someone had to stay home to take care of Ryan. There was no family nearby to help, no neighbors willing to assist, no one, in fact, that we would trust to stay with him for a week. If my wife was to use the trip to relax, I had to stay at home. And I did. Yet while she was gone, we got into an argument on the phone. Heated words were traded back and forth. Neither of us had been treating the other well, and accusations were shouted. Finally, Kat shouted me down. "Look," she finally grounded out, "I know your year has been hard, but do you want to know what my year has been like?" She paused to draw a ragged breath. "I wake up every morning and I think about Ryan, and I look at my beautiful child, a child that I love more than life itself, and I wonder to myself whether he'll ever have a friend. I wonder if he'll ever talk or go to school or play like other kids. I wonder if he'll ever have a date or drive a car or go to the prom. I wonder if he'll ever get married. And I spend all day driving from doctor to doctor, and no one can tell us what's wrong, and no one can tell us what to do. He'll be 4 years old in a little while, and I don't even know if he loves me. I think about this when I wake up. I think about this all day long, and it's the last thing I think about before I go to sleep. I wake up crying in the middle of the night because of it." Her voice was beginning to crack. "That's what my year has been like." When my wife finished, I didn't know what to say. Yes, I was worried about our son, but, and it pains me to admit this, my worries weren't like hers. I'd split my worries between Ryan and my dad, Dana and my book, while my wife had zeroed in on our son. He'd become her entire world. It was the first time I realized the depths of despair that my wife was enduring, and I felt sickened by the argument I'd started. "I'm sorry," I said quietly. "I didn't know it was like that for you." My wife simply sniffed on the other end. "Honey," I whispered. "Yeah?" "I once made a vow to you to love you forever, and now it's time that I make another. I promise. I swear on my heart and soul that I'm going to cure our son." The next day, while Miles stayed at a neighbor's for the day, I went to Walmart and bought a small table and chair. I bought this specific set for the simple reason that the seat had a seat belt with which I could strap my son in. Then, drawing on all the literature I'd read in the previous year, I buckled Ryan into a chair, opened a picture book, and pointed to a picture of an apple while I held a tiny piece of candy out as a reward. I said the word aloud, "Apple," then said it again, and again, and again, "Apple, apple, 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 apple." I repeated the words, willing my son to talk. I don't know that my desire for anything has ever been greater. I concentrated, I focused, my entire world was centered around my son and his ability to say this one single word. Within minutes, Ryan grew bored. Then he started to fuss and fidget. After a few more minutes, he'd begun to cry, trying to get out of the chair. After that, he started to get mad, ferociously mad. He screamed and balled his fists. He tried to pull out his hair. He tried to claw the skin from his arms. He growled and cried out as if possessed. And I'd take his hands, hold them against the table so he couldn't hurt himself and say, "Apple, apple, apple," over and over. He screamed and screamed and screamed. And I said it over and over, and he screamed and screamed. After 2 hours, he could say, "Ah." After 4 hours, he could say, "App." And after 6 hours, my son, 6 hours of angry, frustrated, heartbreaking cries on Ryan's part, said in a tiny, whispered voice, "Apple, apple." For a long moment, all I could do was stare at him. It had been so long, so exhausting, that I didn't believe he'd actually done it. I thought I'd heard him wrong, and I said the word again. Ryan repeated it. And when he did, I jumped up from my seat and began dancing around the room, whooping for joy. I moved toward Ryan and offered a hug. Though he didn't respond to my affection, he said the word again. It was then that I began to cry. Simply to hear the sound of his voice, his voice, no screams, no grunts, no shouts, was breathtaking. It was the sound of angels, as sweet as music. But more than that, I suddenly knew that Ryan could learn. And I then understood that this had been my greatest fear all along. Kat and I had spent over a year wondering what to do for Ryan and whether he would be okay. And by saying this one simple word, I suddenly knew that there was a possibility that he could. This word gave me hope. Until that moment, I hadn't realized that I'd lost every bit of it. I was under no illusions that working with Ryan would be easy or that he would improve right away. I knew the road would be long and frustrating, but he was my son. My son who could learn. I knew then that I'd walk every step of the way with him, no matter how long it took. Taking his little face in my hands, and though I knew he wouldn't understand, I whispered, "You and I are going to work through this together, okay? And I'm not going to quit, so you can't either. And you're going to be just fine." The next day, I worked with Ryan for another 6 hours, and that night I called my wife in Hawaii. I apologized again for the argument we'd had, then put Miles on the phone so he could talk to his mom. When I got on the phone again, I said casually, "By the way, Ryan has something to say to you." I put the receiver up to Ryan's head, held out a little piece of candy, and mouthed the words I wanted him to say. The words we'd worked on all day long. And into the receiver he said, "I wuff you. I love you." These were the first words Kat ever heard him say. That night I made the decision to quit my job selling pharmaceuticals, but I fully understood that I would continue to work a second job. In addition to writing my novels, I spent the next 3 years working with Ryan for 3 hours a day, 7 days a week. And in the end, I would teach him to talk one slow, painstaking word at a time. It wasn't easy. Ryan didn't suddenly get better. It was a horribly frustrating process. It wasn't 2 steps forward, 1 back. It was like a half step forward, then back almost to the beginning, then wander sideways for a while, then go further back than where you'd started in the first place, then finally, tiny improvement. Months after we started, Ryan had begun to parrot words. He could say almost anything, but had no idea what words were or what they were used for. To him, they were simply sounds to get a piece of candy. It would take months and months of effort to finally make him understand that the word apple meant something. There were behavioral issues too, lack of eye contact, poor motor skills, food phobia, potty training. Kat and I worked with him on all those areas as well. He was, for instance, terrified of the thought of going to the bathroom. To finally get Ryan potty trained, I had to strip him down, have him drink glass after glass of juice, and literally sit in the bathroom with him, coaxing him to go in spite of his fears. For 8 straight hours. While the structured work with Ryan lasted 3 hours daily, I didn't want his entire experience with me to be one of struggle and challenge. Thus, my time with him wasn't limited to teaching and learning. I tried to spend at least an hour a day with him doing only the things he wanted to do. We would play on the jungle gym, take walks, coloring, whatever made him happy. But at the same time, I never forgot that I had another son. As a child, I remember believing that attention equaled love, and I didn't want Miles to grow up feeling as deprived as I had. I spent hours with Miles as well, doing the things he liked to do. We rode bikes and played catch. I coached his soccer teams, and he and I would eventually study Taekwondo together. Truly, my children had become my other vocation. In May 1997, we moved back to New Bern, and began remodeling the home we live in today. It was a major construction project, one that took months, but by then moving and remodeling with all the associated stresses seemed almost simple. Kat and I continued to work with Ryan. In August, I finished my second novel, Message in a Bottle, and my sister called later that month to tell us that she and Bob were getting married. Soon after that, Micah and Christine got engaged as well and would be married the following summer. Micah's business continued to grow, and he'd even begun a second business, one that manufactured entertainment centers. Though Dana had begun getting headaches again, she'd been prone to migraines long before she'd been diagnosed, her CAT scans continued to come back negative. Nearly 5 years had passed since she'd first had the surgery, at which point she would technically be in remission. My sister was married in a beautiful ceremony in Hawaii. For a moment, just a moment, it all seemed right in my sister's world. She had the life she'd always dreamed of. She was married, had children, and even had horses she kept at the ranch. Then, while on her honeymoon, Dana suddenly suffered another seizure. And when she got back, the CAT scan showed something it hadn't in years. My sister's brain tumor was growing again. Chapter 16. Valletta, Malta. February 11th to 12th. In the previous 4 days, since the morning before our trip to Agra, we'd spent a total of 5 hours visiting both the Taj Mahal and Lalibela. Our flight time, by way of comparison, was nearly 10 hours, or twice as long. It was the slowing of the pace, and the extent of our travels to that point, that left both Micah and me feeling lethargic by the time we landed. But Malta, with its European flavor and atmosphere, energized us almost immediately. The island was gorgeous, with white rocky cliffs plunging to the blue Mediterranean. The sky was cloudless, crisp, and winter bright. It was our first stop where the temperature was cool, and after donning our jackets, we boarded the buses and made our way to the various sites. Because of the size of our group, we were split into three sections. Ours would head first to the Hypogeum, an underground temple complex discovered in 1902 that was found to contain the remains of 6,000 to 7,000 bodies. The complex is a labyrinth consisting of chambers built over 3 levels and descending to a depth of nearly 40 feet. Dating back to nearly 3600 BC, it is far older than either the pyramids or Stonehenge. It is, in fact, the oldest known structure of any kind in the world, and had been carved from the limestone using the simplest of tools, bone, flint, and hard rocks. Combined with the ruins in other parts of Malta that we'd visit, the Tarshan Temple, which is the oldest known freestanding statue of a deity, and the megalithic temples above ground, which are the oldest freestanding stone buildings ever discovered, it represents one of the earliest advanced civilizations in the world. Yet no one knows who these early people were, where they came from, what happened to them, or where they went. The civilization seems to have vanished as mysteriously as it arrived. Despite this fascinating history of the lost inhabitants, it was Malta itself that Micah seemed most interested in. As we drove along paved roads in which everyone obeyed traffic laws, by then it seemed downright strange, I could see Micah smiling. "You know what this reminds me of?" he asked. "What?" "My trip to Italy," he said. "Right after I graduated from college, when Tracy and I went biking around. It looked just like this. Well, parts of it anyway. That trip was a blast." "Gee, really?" I feigned surprise. "Exploring, meeting new people, having fun? That doesn't sound like your kind of thing." He smiled, no doubt thinking back to our mission gang days. "Did I ever tell you what happened when we first got to Europe?" I shook my head. "Well, Tracy and I flew into Madrid, but because we each had free miles on different airlines, we weren't on the same flight. We were supposed to land at about the same time, but when I went to his gate to meet him, he wasn't on the plane. The thing was, Tracy had everything in his suitcase, the guidebook, directions, maps, even the tools I needed to put my mountain bike back together. And I'm in a foreign country. No one spoke English. I couldn't read any of the signs. I couldn't even figure out who to ask to find out why Tracy hadn't arrived. I didn't even know where the city was in relation to the airport. What did you do?" "I finally found some guy who spoke English, and he helped me. I found out that Tracy got delayed, missed his flight, and that he'd be coming in the next day. but I still had nowhere to go. I didn't even have a credit card back then. I finally found a couple of mechanics who helped me put the bike together, and after they pointed me in the direction of town, I just started pedaling. It took an hour to get downtown, and I still didn't know where to go, where I was going to sleep. I finally found a Hard Rock Cafe, and figuring I could at least find something in English, I went to get something to eat. And after that, things got a little easier. Why? He shrugged. I asked my waitress if she wanted to go out that night, so I went out on a date. A little while later, Micah turned back to me. He'd been busy videotaping the drive. In the end, Micah would shoot 6 hours of video that he'd never end up watching. On the trip, however, you would have thought he'd been filming a documentary. Hey, Nick, have you ever heard of the hypogeum? I nodded. I've read about it. Isn't it supposed to be a tomb? For the most part. But it's the oldest one ever discovered. That's why it's special. He seemed lost in thought. You know what I want a picture of? What's that? A picture of me lying down in the tomb. You know, pretending I'm dead. Wouldn't that be cool? I think it would be kind of disgusting. He gave me an airy wave. Disgusting, cool, same thing. Alas, Micah wouldn't get a chance to have his picture taken amid the dust and microscopic remains of the humans once buried in the hypogeum. The hypogeum was entirely different from any other site we'd visited to that point. For starters, it was located beneath a building entirely unremarkable on the outside. It could have been a restaurant, business, or home, like the buildings on either side of it. The only reason we knew it was a museum were the words stenciled on the glass doors. Inside, we were met by a very serious guide who explained what we could expect. The hypogeum was essentially sealed to prevent decay by the elements. We would walk down the steps and should watch our heads. We would be told where remains had once been discovered. We would see a short movie about the hypogeum first. Tours were scheduled every hour, and it was imperative that we all stay together and move quickly. We should try not to interrupt, for there wasn't enough time to answer questions. We would not be allowed to take pictures. If we did, he would confiscate our cameras. This guy's like a prison guard, Micah whispered. He doesn't even smile. Who, Mr. Cheerful? I think he's sizing us up, trying to figure out who's going to follow the rules and who isn't. I think he knows you're in the latter group. He keeps looking at you. Yeah, he said. I noticed that. For such a happy guy, he's really pretty perceptive. We were led into the climate-controlled, computer-enhanced, video-monitored control room and told to sit in the seats to watch the movie. There was no choice in the matter. You had to watch the movie. Our guide was taking attendance. This essentially is what we learned over the next 15 minutes. Not much. No one knows who built it. No one knows why. No one knows what happened to the people who built it. No one knows where they came from originally. No one knows why it was designed the way it was. No one knows what the civilization was like. All they knew was that it was built long before the pyramids. The lights came on. This way, please, our guide announced. Come, come, we will start the tour in 1 minute. You don't have much time, so try to stay together. Do not ask too many questions, it will only slow us down. And with that, we were led into the hypogeum. It's essentially a cave, and we weren't allowed to touch anything. We walked on a ramp that had been built 6 inches over the floor, ducked our heads, and listened to the guide talk nonstop for the next 40 minutes. And this is what we learned. Not much. Everything he'd said seemed to have been lifted from the movie. Nonetheless, it was a momentous feeling to wander through the oldest ruins known to mankind. And adding to the sense of gravity was our group itself. Our guide had intimidated them all. It's kind of eerie standing in a cave with 20 people, most of whom were friends by now, and not hearing so much as a whisper for an extended period of time. It was the quietest moment on the tour. From there, we went on to the Tarshan ruins, which were located right in the middle of downtown. This time, however, instead of a building, we were led to a small vacant lot, with a few large stones scattered throughout. Machu Picchu, it was not. "This is it?" Micah asked. "Oh, come on, it's not that bad. At least you can shoot video now." There's nothing to shoot. This looks boring. How long are we supposed to be here?
I think an hour.
That's a long time, considering no one knows anything.
He was right. It was a long hour, despite the fact that we had a new guide who actually seemed pleased to see us. Every description began with the phrase, "We think this might be one of two things," or, "We're not exactly sure what this was used for." We also began to frequently hear the word replica, as in, "This is a replica of the pillar, which we think might have been important because of..." After the first few minutes, and no fewer than a dozen replicas, Micah raised his hand.
"You keep saying the word replica," Micah observed.
"Yes," our guide nodded. "It's a replica."
"You mean it's not real?"
"No, the real pillar is in the museum. Most of the real pieces that have been discovered have been removed to indoor museums so they won't be further destroyed."
"And those things you just showed us?"
"They were replicas as well. But they were crafted to look exactly like the originals did." Our guide beamed.
"Isn't it amazing?"
"How much of these ruins are replicas?"
Our guide motioned around her.
"Almost everything you can see, but you can tell what a wonderful job they did." Our guide motioned off to the side.
"For instance, we think this wall may have been used for one of two reasons."
Micah and I quickly lost interest. We weren't actually seeing the Tarshan ruins. We were seeing fakes. It was like being shown a picture of the Mona Lisa when visiting the Louvre instead of seeing the actual painting.
"I can't believe it's not real," Micah said, looking around.
"It's like a movie set."
"Exactly," I added.
"And to be honest, not even a very good one at that." We were on our own for dinner that evening, and Micah and I chose a restaurant near the hotel that served pizza and beer. As we always did when we were together, we found ourselves reminiscing about our early years.
"Do you remember Blackie?" Micah asked.
"The demon bird? How could I forget? Or Horrible Mention?" We laughed uproariously.
"Or how about the time we loaded the van with so many books the van looked like it was being launched?
Or when we pretended to be falling off the edge of the Grand Canyon?" We laughed even harder.
"Or the BB gun wars? That time I shot you in the back and we had to dig the BB out using a steak knife because it was so deep?
Or when Mark and I knocked over the mailbox and those guys beat the daylights out of us?
Or when Grandpa ran the hose over my head? Don't forget the infamous Band-Aid treatments."
We told the same stories we always tell. For some reason, we never seemed to get tired of hearing them. As we doubled over and slapped our knees, people at other tables stared at us, trying to figure out what was so funny. That's the thing, though. Our stories are funny because we live them, and we survive them. The worse the incident was when it was happening, the funnier the story had become to us over the years. In time, Micah grew quiet. He held a warm, almost soulful look in his eyes.
"Now those were good times," he said.
I nodded.
"The best."
After dinner, Micah and I ventured to the casino to try our luck. We played blackjack. Micah won, I lost. And though the casino was far smaller and quieter than those in Reno or Las Vegas, we were pleasantly surprised to learn that a band would be coming in to perform. Our dealer assured us that it was both good and very popular.
"They're local. They've been playing here for years."
"This will be fun, listening to Maltese music. I can't say that I've ever heard it before," Micah said.
"Oh," the dealer said. "Lots of people will come in tonight to hear the band. It will get more crowded later. There will be dancing."
Micah smiled.
"Sounds even better."
Later, we could hear the band setting up behind us. Because we were concentrating on the game, we didn't turn around to watch. A few minutes later, we heard the first chords being struck. At first, we couldn't quite place it. We knew we recognized it. And just as we began to identify the song, the lead singer suddenly began belting out the lyrics from Coward of the County.
Kenny Rogers?
When we turned around, we blinked in disbelief. There, in an upscale casino in Malta, was the local band dressed in cowboy hats, singing American country western songs with their boots tapping to the beat. People in the crowd were cheering and singing along. Micah and I glanced at each other, then burst out laughing. A moment later, joining in with the chorus from the rest of the crowd, we gave each other a what-the-hell shrug and began to sing along. Just when we thought we had the trip all figured out, something like this would happen. The world we discovered was always ready to surprise us. Never in a million years would I ever have imagined that I'd be singing a Kenny Rogers song while attempting a Maltese accent. In the morning, we visited Hagar Rim, another replicated set of ruins. Set near a cliff, the view was more interesting than the site itself, since nothing we saw was actually real. It was, however, a good place for pictures. From there, we traveled to see two of the main medieval cathedrals in Malta. As in Cuzco, they were amazing. With high-arched ceilings, enormous gilded altars, and hundreds of paintings, the detail was overwhelming. The floors are mostly marble, each slab actually the top of a tomb in which various knights had been buried. For lunch, we dined at a seaside cafe. The food was traditionally Maltese, heavy and fresh seafood and bread. And from there, we traveled to the walled city of Mdina. Originally built as a fortress on high ground, miles from the main city of Valletta, the streets were paved with cobblestone and boasted a viewing area from which it was possible to see a great portion of the island. Mdina is also home to St. Paul's Catacombs, and that was our final stop of the day. The catacombs were once the burial sites of hundreds if not thousands of Maltese citizens, and unlike the Hypogeum, we were allowed to touch and photograph anything we wanted. Hundreds of now empty crypts had been carved into the rocky walls. The bodies had been removed and interred in cemeteries years earlier. Micah, of course, raised his hand. "Can I have my picture taken in one of the crypts?" Our guide stared at Micah as if he was insane. "You can if you want to, I guess. No one's ever asked before." "Really? How many years have you been working here?"
17.
Micah winked at me. "You know what that means," he whispered.
"What?"
"I might be the first guy ever to do this," he said. "After the dead guys, I mean." He crawled in, grinning, while I snapped his picture. As we were walking along the cobblestone streets leading from Mdina back to the car, Micah surveyed our surroundings. "I think Christine would like Malta. How about the other places we went?" He glanced at me. "You couldn't drag her to India or Ethiopia, or Easter Island for that matter. For her, traveling to foreign countries means going to London or Paris." I smiled. "I think Kat would have liked all the places we've gone. But since she's never been to Europe, we'll probably go there first."
"When the kids are older, you mean?"
"Of course. But the kids still so young, it wouldn't be that much fun anyway." "You know what we should do? Next summer, we should rent a big house in Italy for a month and bring both our families out. We can make that our home base and travel around from there."
"We'll see," I said. "You don't think that sounds like a good idea?"
"I think it sounds like a great idea. It's just that I don't think it's all that likely. And not just because of my 5 kids. By then, you'll probably have another baby."
"You're probably right. But we should get some information anyway. I'd bet that most of the people on the tour have been to Italy a few times. We can find out the best place to stay."
"You really want to do this?"
"Yeah, we should live a little."
"And you don't think traveling around the world is living a little?"
He thought about it.
"We should live a little more." I laughed. "Would you ever have believed we actually went around the world together and seen all these places? By our age, I mean?" Micah shook his head.
"Never. But then again, if you think about it, we've lived a whole lot of life already."
After his comment, I walked in silence, remembering. In early 1998, Micah was running 2 businesses, working long hours and making plans for his wedding. Along with Bob, he also took over my father's role regarding my sister's health. He began attending all the consultations and took notes. In the evenings, he would consult the physician's desk reference and peruse medical journals online to ensure that my sister was receiving the best care possible. Micah called me with the news as soon as he got back from the oncologist's office. My sister's tumor, invisible only 3 months before, had grown to the size of a grape. While it wasn't as large as the original tumor had been, the size of an egg, it was located deeper within her brain, in an area responsible for both memory and vital motor functions. Because of that, surgery wasn't an option. There was no way to get to the tumor without causing terrible damage. My sister would be left blind and paralyzed in the best possible scenario. More likely, she would either become a vegetable or died during the operation. Nor, we learned, was radiation